Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
but surprisingly for me, you know, I've done the stats. Alistair Aird, who writes some great Rangers books, he did the editing of my book, and Alistair came up with the stats, and I'd played 177 times for Rangers, so I'm proud of that. 177 times. I hadn't get injured and get various illnesses, I'd probably played, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 maybe more. But, you know, unbelievable experience playing at Rangers.
No, it's a thing that it's great when you hear players that appreciate it. And I think the tens of thousands that go to every game and the hundreds of thousands and possibly millions around the world, that I've never been that fortunate. To do it once would be incredible.
Yep.
I played a charity game in an empty Ibrox and felt as if I'd won the World Cup. We got a penalty and Charlie Miller was playing centre forward with me, and before he'd even landed, he got put up in the air. I took the ball and put it in the penalty spot and just looked at me and I thought, you've done this before, I've never. And I thought, when I put it in, I didn't use the Tommy Gemmell advice. I used the Craig Houston advice. I think I took about 4 penalties in my life. I thought, I'll just play sat on the inside the right hand post. But, you know, so to actually have done it once, it's beyond belief in the wildest dreams for so many people. We've done it over 170 times. It's incredible. And I think that team, 81, 86, is that a soft spot? Maybe because it was my first... I'd been and seen Forsyth playing and Colin Jackson playing and all these guys. And then they all seemed to get their testimonials about the same time and then the whole team changed. And I've got memories of them playing. I can distinctly remember going to Ibrox and seeing these guys and my dad telling me all these stories about how great they were and winning European Cup, Winners' Cups and stuff. But you, John McDonald, Ali Dawson, Jim Bett, Peter McCloy, that was my Rangers team. And I think people go on, because what happened in 86, then we started, you know, the whole thing just kicked right on. And it was tough being a Rangers fan then, because there was years where we didn't qualify for Europe. And I remember winning the Skull Cup. And it was a massive thing for me because it was the first time I'd seen Rangers lift a trophy that I can remember. When you hear people being a bit disingenuous to that team, it always gets my back up because you rhymed off that team and the quality in that team was phenomenal. And Bobby Russell, if Bobby Russell probably didn't play at Rangers at the same time as Cooper, I think people would hold Bobby Russell in the same esteem as we hold David Cooper. David Cooper, everybody loves David Cooper, but Bobby Russell was a sublime football player.
Brilliant player, brilliant, and a great guy. And I think the thing is that, you know, they had a telepathic understanding. And after the Aberdeen game, when I'd played a bit part because I'd, you know, almost encroached in their party, the Monday, Coop said to me, "Ah, you get lucky." I said, "All right." And Coop and I got on really well. unbelievable sense of humour, and he said, right, stay back after training. So we were at the Albion, where the car park is now, and got a couple of balls, and him and Bobby, he says, watch this, and him and Bobby, you know, well, it was, I thought it was telepathic, and the fans thought it was telepathic, they worked on it. And basically what happened was Coop would get the ball and he would drag it inside and Bobby would make a run. Coop would reverse pass it in. And then he said to me, right, you come in. And I was like, and I became part of it for a short time. And I thought, genius. The two of them were geniuses. Very natural players, but like every player that gets to the top of their game, it's about the work you do. I remember that, and I took that lesson with Robert Pritz. Him and I used to stay back after training. And I remember Coisty had just joined the club and we didn't know much about him. And we were playing Celtic this Saturday at Parkhead. And we, Pritzy and I said, right, well, let's work something out. And we said, right, Pritzy, if we get a free kick in the middle of the park, I'll get down the line, just play it into me, right? So he said, right, okay. So I go back after we'd practiced that a few times and went into the dressing room and I said to Coisty, see if I get to the dead ball line, where do you want the ball? And he says, oh, just the corner of the 6-yard box. He says, and I'll score. I went, well, that's confidence, right? And he hadn't played a game at that stage. I played a couple, but so we get to Parkhead. Roy Aiken clatters Sandy Clark just inside their half in the mid. So I look at Pritzy, he looks at me, I start running and he plays the ball perfect. I just get it just before it gets to the dead ball line and I play it back to the 6-yard corner. Coisty scores, 27 seconds. It was the fastest goal between Rangers Celtic ever. And see, Coisty said, ah, good pass. I said, just think if we practiced that, Coisty.
We could become good at that.
I know.
No, it was I say, I'm a bit precious about that team in that era. And what happened next was crazy. I mean, I knew you expected that.
See, one of the things, Greg, I would say to you was, like, see the players at that time, they were all Rangers supporters. They were brought up as Rangers supporters. So they stood in the terracing. I stood in the terracing opposite the tunnel. That's where my dad used to take me. And my kind of heroes at the time, John Gregg, Dave Smith, Willie Johnston, Colin Steen. But my favourite was Andy Penman. I loved Andy Penman and I played against him later in my career. Just because he's, you know, the way he went about the, you know, in the midfield, you know, just he always looked as if he was in control of things. So I understood. And all those players understood what it was like to stand in the terrace and support your team. So that synergy, I think, between the players and the fans existed. I was fortunate in my first 2 years that I got over 100 player of the years. And after the first season, what I did was I went to every club, every supporters club, every fans club to collect it, sometimes 3 in a night. You know, travel from, you know, Ayrshire to Lanarkshire to Midlothian and spend some time there. So I did that and I collected everyone. The following season, I get more, wow. Right? And Coop said to me, you only get them because you go to them. He said, I should be the player. I said, no,
you know you'll turn up.
You know you'll turn up. So that's what I did. So I think in writing this book, what I want to do is we almost re-engaged with that because I was treated incredibly well with the Rangers fans. And, you know, what I want to do is reach out to Rangers fans at their clubs and say, look, if you fancy me coming along talking a lot of nonsense about the days at Rangers and what it means and bring my books, then I'd be great to do that. And because I can remember going to Elgin, you know, supporters club at Elgin, you know, 4.5-5 hours travelling up, and then the next night going to Inverness to a Rangers fans group, and then the following night going to Kirkcudbright, you know, to Rangers supporters clubs. So that's what it means. That's what it meant to me to be part of it, because the fans are part of it, and it's a big, big thing between clubs. And I think too often they tend to forget that, you know, because it really means a lot to the fans, but it means a lot to the players, because you're always treated unbelievably.
I think as a fan, you always know when a player's trying. There's no hiding in a football park. There's 50,000 people watching 22 people, but out of the 22, you're probably only watching the one in the ball and the ones in a 10-yard radius, so you might be only watching three or four at the same time. And my early memories of you is it's just a red hair. That was it. this guy turned up for Partick Thistle and he started playing right back. And I always felt there was graft there. There was an honesty there. And I think that's fair to say about a lot of your teammates at that time. There was honesty and graft. But see what you're saying about, I think for a lot of people, if you're a Rangers fan, you put on that jersey, the hope is that you're going to get an extra 10, 20, 30% of effort, because it means more than playing for Roger Respect, Thistle, or Dundee. But is that always the case? Or can it sometimes be a negative with some players? And that is just a mentality thing, that might be a negative for them being a Bear and, you know, having to go and trying too much?
Well, I think a lot of players come to the club and don't realise how big it is and what's required. You know, as you say, the big thing is, the fans giving it 100% in every game. And that was something I wanted to do, because, excuse me, after my kidney removal, one of the things I thought about was, like, you know, how many games are you going to play? And what I decided to do was play each game as if it was my last, because one day I was going to be right.
Yeah.
So I made it from my soul, really, to say, I'm going to go out, and from the start of the game to the finish, I'm going to play to a certain level. I'm going to, come off the park and if realise that I've given 100% to the club. It'll be up to others that maybe add a wee bit of magic to make us win. But to be perfectly honest, as a footballer, you know, whilst I played for Rangers and I grew up a Rangers supporter, it was special, but it was also special playing for other clubs. I played for 7 clubs in total, and I enjoyed playing for the clubs. I became almost like a supporter of that club. I wanted the club to win. I wanted the fans. I wanted to have a relationship with the fans. I wanted the fans to say, by the way, that guy gets stuck in. Because that's what it's about, you know, and I think, you know, too many players don't quite understand that and realise that. And as I say, the bigger the club you go to, you realise that the pressure and the thing that makes you win, and the expectations, managing expectations is a big thing. And a lot of players can't manage that expectation. They go out and play, and then they don't play at the top of their game, because, you know, I think a lot is to do with attitude. And, you know, if you look at Rangers, for example, they've gone through a wee bit of a transitional period. The new manager come in, I'm sure will give players that have maybe not performed the chance. But what happens when new managers come in, some players suddenly realise, well, maybe I've not been performing as well as I can be, or maybe my attitude's not been right. The manager will sort that and get them focused and get them playing. And you can find that when a new manager come in, players that maybe fans have discounted suddenly become good players, suddenly give. But that's a lot of that's to do with attitude, because I think all the players that Rangers have signed have got a lot of skill. They've got they're good players, but it might be just the attitude, isn't it? Right? And a new manager can change that just by getting a word in their ear, an arm around them. Some players need an arm around them. Some players need to be told what they do in a park, what will be success for them, because the good teams that I've played in, the players understood as soon as they went on the park, they understood what their role was within the team, and how, if they performed that role to the best of their ability, throughout the team, success would come. And I think that's the key to it. I think that looking at it from the side, I think maybe sort of players maybe that have come in, they've been used to playing for teams that go in and out of games. You know, they maybe go in and, you know, play for 10, 15 minutes. And because of the type of football or maybe the leagues they've been playing in, they can take a rest for 10, 15 minutes. At Rangers, as soon as you go in that park, you can't take a rest. You're at it from the first minute to the last minute. And I think that that's maybe a transition period that we're going into now. And that's I think that, you know, there are many examples of that I've had in 20 years as a professional of players who've maybe not endeared themselves to the supporters, but suddenly something changes in the way they play, and the supporters say, by the way, what a player that is. He's changed. I'll give you an example of that. I played with Gordon Strachan at Dundee, and Gordon Strachan was an unbelievable player. Low centre of gravity, great attitude, was brilliant. And you knew you could give him the ball and he'd keep it. When he went to Aberdeen, something happened. I don't know what it was when he first went there. And I remember it wasn't in my debut, it was after the Dundee United game, but Patrick Thistle went to Aberdeen to play Aberdeen, and we're doing the warm-up, and I said, Strax, how are you doing? They went, oh, murder. I says, what do you mean? He says, oh, the fans hate me here. I said, oh, come on. I said, I played with you for a number of years, I know exactly what you can do. I says, and one of the things, your attitude's always right. And he said, no, he says, they hate me, right? So Aberdeen took kick-off and played to Gordon Strachan. Boo! Right? Everybody was booing. And I'm thinking, you're right, wee man. And then suddenly became this legend there. So you can turn it around. So I think, you know, if you're, you know, I'm relating to Rangers in the current position, I think players... there are good players there. If they give the right attitude and they get the manager to get the best out of them, I think they might come good. That's what I think. If they don't come good, then it's never going to happen. You need to go through a transition. But I think with Rangers as well, you know, having worked, you know, as an executive level at clubs, the last thing you want is a manager coming in having to clear the place out again, because that sets a club back 2-3 years. Well, and that's the balance at the moment.
Aye, and it's not just the dressing room change, the financial costs in it.
Absolutely.
You obviously then Dunkermarnock, we've already spoke about that and your time there with Tommy and the penalty, Tommy Gemmell penalty. And then obviously you moved into the boardroom and the business side of football. But there was one story in there that I think is very topical. It's because of what's happening with Rangers just now. And it was when Alec Ray was a manager of Dundee.
Yep.
And you had to sack him. But reading between the lines, it's as if you weren't happy with that. And you maybe thought, one, it was the wrong decision, but you were still professional enough to just go and deal with it, because the decision's been made. Your role dictates you do it. Or Maybe it wasn't. You were maybe just shoved into that with somebody that didn't want to do it. Was maybe how I read it. But could you talk about that time at Dundee and what happened there?
Yeah, well, I believe that I spoke about that synergy between a club from top to bottom. There's different languages throughout a football club. There's the boardroom language, which is strategic and, you know, making sure that they don't lose money, they get money in and all that kind of thing. But they still want a good team in the park. You've got the football side of it, where it's like short term. Let's win on Saturday. Let's get our injuries back. If we sign this player, we might, you know, improve the team during the transfer window. And then you've got the fans. You know, they want to mirror what the dressing room's doing about winning every game. But I understood that language at clubs because I played football. I could talk to the board. I'd also had a vast experience in business. I was at Tenants for 12 years, an unbelievable education in business. and then had my own pub company. So a new business and a new every aspect of financial, you know, strategic, everything. So, but I was at Kilmarnock, and first of all, and basically the boardroom, I was a football guy, right? So I knew the language of the dressing room. And what was happening was Kilmarnock, believe it or not, they were third or fourth in the league. And when the director said, oh, we've been beaten the last couple of games, I think we should get rid of the manager. And it was Jim Jeffries and Billy Brown who had taken we'd taken £1 million out of the budget. And they were performing miracles. Two great guys that conscientious. And the owner of the club said, we brought Dave McKinnon in for his business acumen, but also his football acumen. Would you think the worst mistake we'll ever make? I said, the manager's done absolutely brilliant. He's got, you know, 12 injuries. They're all coming out. I spoke to the physio. They're coming back in. We'll get back in and we'll end up fourth in the league. The owner, Jamie Moffat, says, right, Davey, you're the football guy. I'll take that on board. Now, if there was not a football voice in there, they would have sacked Jim Jeffries, and it would have been the worst move they made. It was a similar thing at Dundee. What happened at Dundee was I was part of a four-man board. There was a fans representative, George Knight, who was brilliant, understood exactly what we could say to the fans and what we couldn't say. I used to go to a fans meeting every month, and I used to give it from the football perspective. With chairman Bob Brannan, and financial director Ian Bodie, and me, and we should have agreed that we'd a quarter vote, if you like, on decisions. But ultimately, I was supposed to have a football decision. But basically, what happened, we were beaten. I think we were only five points off the top of the league. It was a lot of players injured at Dundee. Alec Ray was doing a great job, and I got a phone call on the Sunday, because they were all from the Dundee area. Oh, we had a meeting after the game, and the three of us wanted to get rid of the manager. And I said, it's the worst move you can ever make. I said, he's got injuries similar to what happened to Jim Jeffries. I said, so this is not a football decision that I agree with. And from a football perspective, I don't agree with it. And what they said was, well, it's a 3-1 vote, so you're voted out. And I went up to Dundee. I was told to go up to Dundee and sack Alec. And I brought Alec into the club, and he was doing very, very well, him and Davy Farrell. And but I walked up to Dundee and into the solicitor's office, and a Dundee United director was sitting, John Bennett, who was a property guy, really good guy. But basically what happened is he had arranged to buy the stadium from the club because there was a debt there. And the bank, it was the banking issues of 2008, banks were going out of business. The Royal Bank of Scotland were pulling in every debt they could. So they'd asked for Dundee. I think there was a £3 million loan against the stadium. And they would write that off for £500,000. That was a strange thing that were going on at that time. And John Bennett agreed to fund that and buy the pitch, buy the stadium. And I didn't agree with that. And then John gave me an email and said, there you go. So John made the decision to get rid of the manager because he was going to buy the club, and he didn't want Alec Ray being the manager. And I said, absolutely outrageous. And they said, if you looked at point five, I looked at point five, and it says, Dave McKinnon to resign as chief executive, and a Dundee United board member to come in as the chief executive. And I just said, outrageous. Now, as I was leaving, some people try and look after themselves, and I just told them to stuff it. I wasn't doing it. But, you know, that again, that having to do that professional job, I was getting paid. And so I went up and sacked Alec Ray. And I couldn't tell Alec exactly why it was. And he was quite rightly raging. But I made the decision I was leaving the club anyway. I just,
if it's any consolation, he knows now.
I told him.
Oh, you've told him since. Because I'd said to him over the weekend, I said, came up in the book. I'm reading it now. He's like, where did you get the book? I told him.
I phoned Alec because what I wanted to do is, I didn't want him reading it, about it in the papers. Yeah. And it was a personal thing that I had no control over. And it was the wrong decision. And what I said to the three board members when I left, I said, you're making a terrible decision here. I said, we're on track with a three-year plan. We'll get promoted to the Premier League. That's the objective. The fans understood it. Everyone at the club. So we were perfectly aligned. And we knew what the objective was. And we'd have got promoted. But they weren't for it. And I said to the board, you'll end up with administration again. Because I'd joined the club after administration and took a significant amount off the wages to get back on track. I had a three-year plan that the board agreed, and we were working to it, and we ripped up the plan and started buying players. And, you know, Lee Griffiths, they signed for 150 grand. Gary Harkins from Thistle for 100,000. Where was this money coming from? Because they couldn't have an overdraft. So I knew that, but they had, you know, someone said they were going to invest money into the club and they were going to fund it. And that person disappeared at the tail end, and they were left with a huge wage bill. They didn't have an overdraft. The bank wouldn't allow them an overdraft. They couldn't pay for things, so they went into administration again. And that was so sad for me looking in the sidelines, but I saw it coming. So I talk about that in the book to a certain extent. But it was great for me to actually phone Alec and phone Davy Farrell and say to them, look, I'm giving you a heads up on this. Here's the reason. It was nothing to do with your ability or how you perform. That's the reason. Can you change the past? But what I want you to do is make sure that you hear it from me rather than read it in the papers.
Fair play. I know Alec, and there's a story from Christmas time. That I was taking the piss out of him, to be honest with you. But when I tell you the story, you realise that in itself will tell you how good a coach Alec is.
He's a great coach, great manager.
I was going down to take my girlfriend, her wee boy, down to Windsor in Legoland between Christmas and New Year. And we, Alec was at Reading at the time. Uh-huh. So I've texted him, and we actually booked a hotel in Reading to stay in. And they were playing Swansea that night. So the wee man got us a couple of tickets for in the players' lounge. And he came in after the game and he said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, we're going to, it was Legoland about lunchtime or something. He says, well, see if you want, I'll come in. I'm going into training about 8:30. If you want to come in, they'll show you in the complex. Outstanding.
He's a brilliant guy. He's a brilliant guy, Alec.
Well, when he gets there, we're walking through, and he's introducing me to everybody in the building. And he says, aye, Ince will be in 30 minutes or so, right? So, Paul Ince, I think, you know, I've met some football players in my time. You're a proper football player. So, he introduced them. They'd won that night. And he says, aye, Alec says, you were a lucky charm. He says, do you fancy coming to Norwich on Thursday? We could do with another 3 points. And I said, Paul, can I ask you one question? And he says, how about, is it? I says, right, you played for West Ham, Liverpool, Man United, Inter Milan. You were the first black captain of your nation. You've played with some proper football players through time, haven't you? He went, oh, I played with a few. I says, but you've ended up with him as your assistant manager. And I mean, you could have picked... Through your phone book, you could have 10, 20, you know, you went for Alec. And I was suffering, taking the piss out of Alec at the time. But seeing you actually consider that, and he's been against probably 3-4 clubs, Blackpool.
What happened was Alec said to me that when they played against each other a lot, and him and Ince on the park, they were similar. Yeah. They wanted to win. They were winners. And... he said they never got on the park. They were kicking each other and all that kind of thing, and they were shouting at each other and all that kind of thing. And then when Alec was transferred to Wolves, Paul Ince was there, and they went, oh, no, no, you. At least you're playing the same team as me. And the two of them got on really well. Yeah. And, you know, they obviously had that career, you know, together. But Alec is a brilliant guy, as you know, and... he's very passionate about life, about he had his troubles, which he was very honest coming out about, which was great. And he gets stick for that, being so honest from people that don't really matter, because he's got a great family, he's a great guy. And I was absolutely delighted that he's got the opportunity to come in and be involved in Rangers. And I hope the manager keeps like him and you know, the rest of them on, really, just because you need that Rangers head. You know, in whatever capacity, because he deserves it, because he's worked hard. every time I see a testimonial game or something like that, I see him pulling that shirt on, you know.
It was part of one of the, in modern times, one of the biggest days in the career was, the history of the club at that probably 20-year gap was Helicopter Sunday. He's part of that.
I know.
Forever. He'll be forever, there in the videos and stuff. No, he's a great guy. And when I was reading it, I was having a chortle and I thought, I wonder if he man knows this when he gets sacked.
Why did he?
Because I remember when he was going through the same at St Mirren, and I thought the way he got treated there was a bit harsh, and he was going through a bit of a hard time at St Mirren with the fans, and they were playing Dumbarton away. And me, Ginge, was a Dumbarton manager at the time with Durant, and I can't remember where I was this day, and it was a Saturday at 5, I must have been later than that, maybe about 6 or 7, and me, Ginge and Durant came into the district, and I said, "What's the score of Davy, man?" He says, "None each." I said, "None each for St Mirren, aye." He says, "I'll be you get my wee pal the sack in." He says, "Can you know, Dumbarton, the dugouts at the other side for the tunnel." Yeah. He says, "So we're walking across." He says, "And I can see the whole St Mirren fan base all running towards the tunnel. They're all screaming at you, you had dirty orange bee." And the ginger's like, "I thought they were talking to me." And it was Ali, and then that was him. And I think maybe a wee bit early coming out of there as well. Similar to Dundee, maybe with the change of board.
When I look back on that, I think if Alec had stayed, I think if I'd have stayed, I think Dundee would have got promoted that season. I don't think they'd have gone into administration because I was very understanding of the finances. But also the board members were, Bob Brannan is a great guy. He was chief executive at Rangers. Knows the game, but for some reason, himself and the other two directors decided to make that change.
You think that thing you were telling us about the loan to the stadium, to having a bank allowing you to write off basically a multi-million pound loan for half a million?
It was even worse than that, because there was another 4 million in another account, and they came out of administration. And what I couldn't understand was why that debt was allowed to be parked. Because that was part of the whole thing, of the debt. And, the bank obviously didn't want to write it off. So what they did was they put it in two accounts, one under the stadium and one, they had an agreement. I saw that an agreement there, right? And it was for 4 million. And what that was should Dundee ever...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sell a player over £1 million, then the bank would get 50% of it.
Wow.
But this loan doesn't incur any interest and doesn't have to be repaid. Now, that's what the bank had said at that time. And currently, if you were to say that to people, the banks would write off. But, the carnage of 2008 when, basically... Banks were. I know a lot of business people who had very, very good businesses, and they maybe had £100,000 overdraft, and they were maybe at their limit. The bank would say, unless that's paid by a certain date, we're pulling the plug. And there was a lot of businesses went out. It was ridiculous, to be perfectly honest, that was allowed to go on. There was a lot of good businesses went out of business because.
Down to the mismanagement of the banks, more than the mismanagement of the particular businesses.
I'd actually, someone who worked, I knew someone that worked with the banks at that stage, and some of the stuff that was going on was just outrageous, to be honest.
Ask you a question, a sort of fantasy football type question, right? I won the Euro Millions and we go and buy a club. We can't just afford it, just right. So we go, let's buy one down south. And I say, right, who do I know that can help me? Right, David, come on in. There's a blank piece of paper. Design the football club for me. Tell me what that looks like.
Yeah.
They give us, you know, as much chance of success as possible.
Right. Well, what you need is, as I said to you, all has to be aligned. So you need a board that set out a clear strategy. So we need to agree a plan and a timescale to deliver that plan. So we agree that. We speak to every area within the club. We speak to the football side at that stage. We speak to the fans. We speak to the staff. We get everyone involved. When I go into a company, the first thing I do is I have a hour meeting with every member of staff and I pose them a couple of questions. What's a barrier to you achieving what you want to achieve? And what's good? What's working? And what would you need to make things work? What do we need to do here? So I get all that, gather that information. And a lot of it comes down to communication, not understanding the clear plan. So you get a clear plan, set that up, get all the stakeholders, everyone, you make them aware of that plan, you know, fans and all of them. Here's what we're laying out, what our plan is, and you get a buy-in for it. So everyone that's involved in the club, from the board to the football manager to the staff to the fans, know what the plan is and what the timescale's on with that. So you do that, you also get a representative of the fans on board, and on the board, someone that understands the plan and understands what the fans have to do to make that plan work, and is a very good communicator, because one of the things is communicating that, where you are along the line of the plan. And then what you do is you look at your finances and say, right, well, what can we afford here to pay out in wages for the players? And then what you do is you get, if you've got a good manager that you're behind, that's great. If you decide that it's needing a change, you get a change. But what you do is you get someone in who understands the business side as well as the football side, and they can link the two. And what you do is say, right, okay, how are we going to play? What's your style of play? And a lot of people say, well, you're interfering. No, you're not. What you're doing is you're understanding exactly what the manager's requirements are. You get all that down, and then what you do is, at clubs that succeed, what they do is they have a style of play, and then what they do is they bring in the players to fit that style of play. There's a lot of teams, as you probably see, where they have a style of play, and what they do is they say, let's sign that one because he scored 20 goals or he's been a great defender, but it might not fit into the style of play. So what you have to do is that understanding with the manager. We bring in players to fit the style of play that you play, and you basically implement that, but you communicate on a regular basis of where you are within a club. And also you got a scouting system, and you got a really good scouting system. And I'm part of a Rangers WhatsApp group of players that played in the 80s. And there's some people in there from around the world that very, very good football people, understand the game, have been managers and coaches. Colin Miller in Canada. In America, Bobby Williamson in Africa, Stuart Minot in Australia. And we talk regularly about players, and all of those three and others, Big Nizzy in Spain, they've spoken about players and said, by the way, the club should buy, Rangers should buy this player. I remember Bobby Williamson telling me that he'd written to the club to say there was a player in Africa that I think could have got for 500,000. And he says he's one of the best strikers I've seen in the game. Now, Bobby knows the game inside out. And I think he'd sent something in to the club to say, I think you should have a look at him. But it didn't happen. And the guy signed for a Bundesliga team. And I think a Premiership club in England's trying to buy him for 20, 30 million at the moment. So that happens. So you need to get a network of people that understand football and understand players that will come into that system. So that it's relatively easy to set that up. But see, once you've got the plan, you need to stick to it. But, you know, and if you have to deviate for some reason, you need to advise and communicate with every stakeholder and say, we're changing this strategy and the way we're going, and here's the reasons why. And people buy into that. It's about buy-in all the time.
And do you think in a modern game, rather than just having the manager alongside a scouting department, recruitment department, whatever that looks like, and whatever you want to call it, do we need a technical director stroke, director of football, and not a director of football in terms of dealing with the business side, but, you know, dealing with the planning for recruitment, you know, that guy's got 2 years left in his contract, we'll probably need to get rid of him in a year. Is that a necessity at top clubs these days?
Well, I think top clubs have gone that way. I think because chief executives maybe don't have that knowledge. So they need to bounce things off, you know, a technical director or a director of football. Because I think the thing is, you know, you're right, it's about managing players' contracts. You know, if you look, I don't want to keep reverting back to Rangers, but if you look at Morelis and Kent, you know, see, part of the thing, even at, you know, the clubs I've been at, what I've done is always said, right, well, somebody's come out of contract, you offer them an extension, and if they don't want an extension, they go, because you maximise the money. That happened with me, where there was a boy, Kevin McDonald, played for Scotland. Kevin was a great player, and I spoke to him at Dundee, I spoke to him and his agent and said, look, want you sign an extension, because we wanted to protect the club. And him and his agent says, no, I'm not signing a contract. So what I did was I said, right, okay, well, I'm going to move you on. And what I did was sold him for a big, big fee for Dundee, £500,000 to Burnley. Same thing happened at Kilmarnock with players, you know, moving them on because they don't want to sign an extension because they're just going to run down their contract. And what I've seen is like clubs when players are in the final year of running down their contract, they don't give you it.
It's something that I can't stand buzzwords, right? When I manage people, try and be a straight talker and we'd have goals, we'd have majority of my managing time is sales teams. And our target's over there somewhere, and I'll run to that. If you can run with me, that's great. See if you even jog with me. That's all right. See if you walk the other way, being just finished. Right? That was my type of management, and I can't be bothered with buzzwords. And the I'm trying to remember the recruitment, some shitey buzzword we heard at Rangers for years. And then Kent and Morelis leave for zero. Now, I know there was £29-30 million worth of bids for those two, you know, so long ago. And you go, it's just buzzwords. It means nothing. And if you're saying if you've got a plan, you stick to the plan. But we see a lot of faffing about. And we say the buzzwords, and we call this the plan today because it suits today's agenda. But tomorrow, so we tell everybody we've got these recruitment strategies.
But you need a 5-year plan, football club.
So we tell everybody we're doing these recruitment strategies and, you know, the way we're going to manage our squad. And it does involve going out and finding good gems that we can resell for big profits. And then you go, but Bassey. Well, that's right. But we got lucky with Bassey, we got lucky with Patterson. There was another two. If that's your strategy, that's your strategy. And I mean, I saw those two in the last year where there were a shadow of the players that we'd seen previously. And then they walk out of the club for zero. You go, it was just a buzzword.
No, well, I think the thing is, like, is that's irrespective of how much money you've got. And I know one of the things that the Rangers directors have done is they've put their money where their mouth is. They've put money investment in the club. But I think that probably... Looking at those two players, even in getting into their last year of their contract, I reckon you'd get 15, 20 million for the two of them. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever that, you know, broke down for each player, I don't know. But there was certainly, I know at the time you could have done that. Now, getting that kind of money into Rangers would be significant. Mm-hmm. Because no club, irrespective, they can afford to you know, see money walking out the door, and that's what happened, really. So I don't know how that happened. I don't know anything about it.
I think it's just bad planning and no sticking to, you know, saying that's what we're going to do, no doing it. But see, there was one thing I do take exception to a certain degree is, but they've put money in. Every Rangers director that's put money in is getting their money back in two ways. Either cheap shares, because we were told that they were worth 40 pence a year ago when an American wanted to buy some. And when they put their loans in or put the money in, they're getting shares at 25 pence.
I don't know what the financials behind it is, but I'm just saying, you know, if you've got people on the board, sometimes in a boardroom, they have to be asked to look, we need to put some money in here, and they do it.
If I had money and somebody said to me, if you should put £500,000 in and we'll give you Rangers shares at 25 pence right now, I'd do it in a minute. If I had £500,000 to give Rangers and somebody says, we'll pay you back at 6% interest right now, I'd have it in a minute. So the Rangers board are good at putting money in. But every penny they put in, they're getting back either cheap shares or with interest nowadays. The Rangers fans, every year, put in more money with the season tickets alone and don't get anything back by the enjoyment of a football club. And I do appreciate, I'm not saying I don't appreciate what people do, because if they don't put the money in, we might not have existed since 2012. But I've always got that caveat with it.
Well, see, Dundee were saved by D for Life.
Yeah,
and they restructured the club and gave D for Life 26%. And you know, any arrangements, you know, work across every member of the board. So D for Life were there 26%, and without them, the club would never have survived. I don't know what happened at the second sort of administration, but I think D for Life, I don't think they've got the shares that they've got, they had originally then. But you know, I think the thing is, like, I think there's a, you know, I think clubs can ill afford to ignore their fans.
Yeah, God.
I think they have to get them on board and embrace it. And for a fans' perspective, though, I think that, you know, I don't know how many different associations there are at Rangers with the fans group, but see if there was one focus. I think that would be a better idea for me.
Yeah, I could bore you to death. We could do an hour on that alone, but that's what the club wanted when they brought in Club 1872. They wanted to say, rather than speak to this and that, we'll have a one-stop shop, and that was to become a multifaceted organisation. And it was great, and it worked well until Club 1872 started asking some serious questions. Yeah. And the club stopped talking to them.
Right.
They had a 6% shareholding, major shareholder, and they stopped talking to them. And now what the club's doing currently right now is, they're going to create a fan board. Guess who picks a fan board?
Club.
The club. Right. And you go, I love Rangers as much as the next guy and more than some. And I think, and this is something I actually spoke to one of our directors about a year ago, just before he blocked my phone number. And I said, see, when guys ask questions or want clarity and transparency, it's not because they hate you. It's actually through a passion. And I think football fans in general, the default setting of a football fan, and that's probably why so many shysters take this out of football clubs, default setting for a fan is you want to believe everything that's good that somebody says, and you want to ignore what's bad. So if somebody with big Yorkshire hands, for example, comes along and tells you he's going to get his back in the Premier League quick, then the Champions League and all this, people go, I want to believe him. So then somebody else comes along and says, by the way, he's a thieving shite. Nobody wants to listen to him. So it's very easy for people with the wrong...
I think any club has to be transparent. Everyone has to be transparent, because you've got nothing to hide, really.
Yeah.
You've got nothing to hide.
So?
And I think that's the only way it works. And so going back to the thing about creating a football club.
A blank piece of paper.
Transparency is the biggest thing. And without transparency, it won't work, because all you're doing is, it's a house of cards that will eventually collapse because of whatever happens in the future. So, but it's a great game, football, but I think the thing is, like, it's a simple game that's complicated, that people complicate and they put layers in and all that kind of thing. Just make it slim, get the stakeholders involved, communicate with them, be transparent. That's the way it's... I've never met John Bennett, but I know someone I trust and respect, and he knows him very well, and he tells me he's a wonderful guy and he wants the best for the club. So that's great. So I'm sure you know, if John Bennett believes that, that in this and in a model that's open and transparent, it will happen.
I think that I just comment to somebody about a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about, in fact, it was somebody just recently left the club, and I said, see the guys that we've got involved in our chairman and the board, I don't think any of them are not successful in their chosen field. And the reason I don't even need to go and look is the amount of money they've been able to put in their back pocket and put on the table. So you must be good at what you do or you wouldn't be in that position. The only thing I feel we've got a problem with is their chosen field, they're successful, and then none of it's football. And we just need some proper football people in to help guide that along.
I got a stick, do some work for PLZ Soccer, and I was asked when Michael Beale went about how they should recruit, and I said that they should get someone as a consultant in to help the board make the right decisions from a football perspective. Yeah. Because what I meant with that, and I suggested Graham Souness and it happened, but not because of what I said it, but I think it was, they were probably thinking about it the same way. But what I meant with that was, see, when you've got managers that you're interviewing, right? See if you don't understand from a football perspective what they should be doing, or indeed what is important. Managers or anyone could tell you, this is what I've done, this is what I'm doing, this is the way I operate, this is what my plans are going forward, this is this is how it's going to operate, and this is what I'm going to achieve. Now, that could be correct, but it might indeed be quite a hollow thing. But see if you're a guy that understands football or a woman that understands football and you ask the relevant football questions, you know straight away whether they're going to deliver it. And that's what I meant with, get somebody in that can ask the question. If somebody says to you, yep, I'm going to organise, right, your scouting system, how do you see your scouting system operate? And they tell you exactly, here's what I've done in the past, here's the success that's done it. A football guy will understand whether that can be achieved.
I could smell the bullshit.
Well, you said that, not me. But I think that, that was what I meant with it, because with respect to the board and the CEO, very good business people, but they may don't know what the football question is. And to their credit, they got Graham involved, and I'm sure he helped in a lot of ways. And it worked well.
We've got a manager. Right. Well, look, David, it's been a fascinating 2 hours. It just flies in, doesn't it? Can I thank you enough for your time today in doing this? And what I try and achieve with these is find out what's behind the character that we've known, for 40 years through your playing career and your time in the football. And I think we've succeeded in that somewhat today. Some of the stories and insights you've given has been incredible. But just before we finish, can I ask you just a couple of quick fire questions off the top of your head? Best team you played against?
Probably Benfica.
Wow. When was that?
It was when I was at Arsenal.
Is that right? Was that out there? Or?
No, it was in London. So.
Wow. Big club. I chartered a plane at the end of COVID, and took 120 kids out there for a day, and took them to their stadium and their training facility, and then went back out 6 months later for a 4-day trip. They were under 14s or 15s at the time. What a club. That's a proper football club.
Well, they had a good relationship with Arsenal, and it was a closed door thing. Yeah. So what they did was they just came across, played their first team, and it was a great experience because it was actually myself and all these guys that I've spoken about played against, and we played the show pitch, and we played in that, and it was all part of your education.
That's it. Best player you played with?
Davy Cooper, definitely Davy Cooper. I also played with Liam Brady, who was an incredible player, but I played against Liam Brady when Rangers beat Inter Milan 3-1, and I was basically up against him, and he never got a kick, to be honest, because I knew See, the thing is, like, if you know how people play, you can actually stop them playing that way. And that's just to, you know, because what Liam did was he played within a 12-yard area. And if you can cut off the ball to him or you put him under pressure, he'll still do you know, occasions. But with playing him for 4 years, I knew. I knew what his first touch was. So I would try and either stop that ball getting to him or
get a second ball.
But he was a great player as well. But David Cooper, definitely.
Aye. Who was your toughest opponent you came across?
Probably Peter Weir, I would imagine. Because I think it took me a long time to get to know his game. When I was at Arsenal, Pat Rice helped me out enough a lot on how to play as a right back, how to defend. And I played against George Best as well.
Wow.
But Pat said to me, said, who's your favourite player? I says, George Best at that time, because he was just amazing. And he said, I played against Best, as you know, and he's in the Northern Ireland side of me. He said, I'll tell you how to play him. And I was like, oh, right, okay. So we used to go into the Highbury pitch after training and used to get a ball. And what Pat used to say was, watch, he moves his body, but the ball doesn't move. So keep your eye on the ball and you'll get it. And I remember Coop was the same when I played against him when I was at Thistle. Coop moved his body, but the ball stood still. And he'd do a wee feint and players would go off balance and then he'd take that. And he said to me, Coop, after the first game, he says, I need to keep my eye on you. Because I took the ball off him a few times. He was very gracious. And that was what it was. But George Best was the same.
Incredible.
Incredible player.
What was the biggest game you ever played in your career?
Crowd-wise, I played in front of 100,000 in Iran for Arsenal against Iran in a tournament, right? Biggest game, I think, was obviously for Rangers. I think we played in a lot of big Europeans. We played Porto, and there was 80,000 there. So, you know, big games, big atmosphere. But interestingly, when you play on a regular basis in front of big crowds, it's just a buzz. You don't hear anything. Although, I need to admit this, I played in the Scottish Cup final against Aberdeen, and the Rangers fans, you know, were at their usual end, and there was a break in play. And I looked up to the Rangers end, and out of, I don't know, it's probably 40,000 Rangers fans, I saw a guy that was in my class at school.
No way.
Called Asmo.
That's what, about 80, mid 80s?
83, I think. And wow. I looked up and it was the most strangest thing ever. So I'm looking up at the Rangers end and I'm thinking, look, fans are great again. And then I see, oh, it's no, is it? My sight was a lot better those days. It was Asmo. That's it. I sat beside in school. I knew him. And I just was.
And have you seen him since?
No.
I wonder if he knows that bit of fame that he's got that he never knew. So just one last question, David. Again, can't thank you enough for your time today. It's been superb conversation and journey into the life of you. If you could rewind it back to being that kid playing in the 50 pitches and the race course at Paisley and stuff and do it all again, would you change any of it?
Yep, I would have changed it. Well, this is the thing, is, and again, writing this book has got me to a place where I'm very comfortable with my decisions because I understand them now. But if I hadn't gone to Arsenal and I'd gone to Ipswich, would I have played for Rangers? You know, if I didn't walk away from Arsenal, would I have played with Rangers? If I hadn't had my kidney removed, would I have played for Rangers? You know, and I think the thing is, like, as you get older, you know, people say, oh, that's Dave McKinn that used to play for Rangers. They wouldn't say, oh, there's Dave McKinn that played with Everton and Ipswich. if you know what I mean. So I wouldn't change anything. I What I do now is like I speak to players that I know, young players who are maybe going through an injury time in their life. There's a couple of players that I'm speaking to at the moment who've got kind of, you know, longer term injuries that they've battled through and they're coming back to. So I phone them up periodically and say, how are you doing in your rehab? Because it's a lonely place. It's a lonely place. And see, when you're out injured, it's very difficult for to feel part of it. So that's what I do. And I think I'd like to mentor a lot of young players about their game and you know, particularly when they go through injuries, about how they would, you know, how, what they need to think of, what they need to concentrate on. Because ultimately, see, when you get through a long period of injury, you come out the other end, and see, when you start playing again, you don't think of that term you went through, but as you're living it and breathing it, you have to keep positive. You need to ensure that you don't lose focus, you don't get too depressed, too down, because if you work hard enough to try and get back, you ultimately get back. I'll tell you a story lastly about Rangers. And it's spoke about it in my book, but it was never discussed at the time. But when Jock Wallace came, we played against Aberdeen. It seems to be Aberdeen, this thing's up. But we played against Aberdeen and we stayed at a hotel and I got hepatitis A, believe it or not. And I was out for 6 months. And what the club didn't do, because it was just at the tail end of the AIDS and all that kind of stuff, and hepatitis, you know, a lot of the drugs, things. And I had hepatitis A, which it's got nothing to do with drugs or anything. It's just it's a liver illness, and it was caused by fruit that I had at a hotel in Aberdeen, because there was an outbreak and I think 40 people got it. I should have claimed in those days for loss of earnings, but I was out for 6 months, and the club, I was basically just told to go home for 6 months and no come near the club. Not because of the stigma around AIDS. There was a lot of stigma around AIDS and hepatitis at that time, but it was simply because that I needed a time to recover. I lost a lot of weight, but I was almost isolated. But every Saturday after the game, Jock Wallace would phone me at the house, because remember, there's no mobiles. And he'd phone me at the house and he said, how you doing, Skippy? What did you do the day? I said, oh, just shuffled about and ate rice, because I was eating rice. That's all I could eat. Couldn't eat any fats because my liver had to repair. And he said, right, okay, well, let me tell you about the day's game. And he would talk about the game, how we played, who played well, who didn't play well. And I would ask him questions about the game and all that kind of thing. And he phoned me for 6 months. Every Saturday, and if there was a Wednesday game, he'd phone me after that. So, I mean, that takes a certain human being to do that, because I was away from the club. I was not near the club, and I'd lost almost contact with it. But Jock Wallace did that for me, and you know, what a man he was.
Oh, fair play, Oh, can I ask you one more question, then that'll lead on to best manager that you had in your career?
John Gregg for me.
Yeah.
Not just because he signed us, but he epitomised what the club was about. He set unbelievable standards. Tommy and McLean was a great foil for him as a coach. The two of them worked really, really well. And it was a sad day when he was sacked, because I think there was a lot of knives out for him in the boardroom. And I think, given his status, I think he should have been allowed to be the manager for a longer time. I actually saw him coming down the stairs. We came in from the Albion training, and he was coming down the stairs, and he just basically, I think he'd been forced to resign, and he resigned, and he was upset. And to see somebody you'd idolised and respected as a manager and as a player coming down in tears and the stairway at Ibrox was very poignant for me. And it gave me a big lesson that in football that there's no loyalty.
No, if you could be player, captain, lifted the best, you know, the biggest ever victory in the club's history.
He should have been given a lot more time, I think, and also a bit more resources to, because we started, even the team he was rebuilding, it started to disappear. Big John McClelland, who was such a great player,
Watford,
was sold to Watford. Jim Bett was sold back to Lochran.
Did he not go to Aberdeen? Was he
went to Lochran, back to Lochran. He was at Lochran, came to Rangers, and then was transferred back to Lochran. And he was a great player. They should have given, I think, the manager the funding at that time. But I think, as I say, there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes. I thought the decision was already made to get him out the door. And that was a terrible thing. It was a terrible thing for me to see as a player. But also as a fan, it was a terrible thing. And John Gregg, as you know, is one of the most genuine guys you'll ever meet in your life. Brilliant man.
One of my early memories of watching Rangers was coming out. We used to come out of the main stand, turn right, walk past the front door and go over to Albion. When you had a season ticket, you could park in there at the time when we still had the training ground over there. And I just remember Greg Moscow or his chance and sat Greg, and I was like, I didn't know too much about him, but you know, I was brought up in all the stories with Barcelona and, you know, the captain and stuff. And I just thought, that's a bit weird. And was this maybe one of the first times where fans influenced the board, then that's maybe what
I think that you're maybe right, but I think the thing is, like, you know, I don't think there was an investment in the team that should have been, because, you know, the club was making a lot of money. I remember we played Inter Milan here at Ibrox, and basically there was reported that the club were making something like, I think it was something like 700,000 for the game, because what they'd done was they'd sold the rights to Italian TV. It wasn't on Scottish TV at that time, because the highlights are basically on YouTube, and it's REI. So they'd sold the rights to the game for a significant amount of money. And if you notice, if you watch that game, all the advertising recordings are all blocked off because they put in their own. So the club made a phenomenal amount of money. And remember, the players didn't earn a lot of money in those days. So therefore, the club were sitting in a lot of money at the time. And I think it could have been better invested in supporting John Gregg. That was my view. You know, and who knows what would happen, because he was a really good manager. Very, very good manager. Very conscientious, knew the club inside out. And see, you know, obviously when Souness came in, the whole thing changed. But even Jock Wallace wasn't supported a lot during that time. I think that when people look back in those days and they may think, it's down to the manager, it's down to the players, but they don't know what else is going on behind the scenes. So,
well, Great couple of hours, Davey. Just before I go, just need to thank again our sponsor for this episode, Impact Glasgow Building Solutions, and just thank you for a splendid couple of hours and some great stories.
Remember, if there's any supporters clubs out there that want to, you know, make them along for a night to talk about football and maybe bring some guests, if they contact yourself, that'd be great. We can do that.
Well, listen, so, absolute pleasure. Really, thank you very much, David.
Great.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.